Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is John Dean, whose latest book is Conservatives Without Conscience. John Dean is the author of several other books, including, most recently, Worse Than Watergate. John Dean was involved in the Watergate situation back in the 70s. John Dean, after writing Worse Than Watergate, which discusses the secret presidency of George W. Bush, you chose to focus on the authoritarians in the administration and in the conservative milieu of the United States. So let me start by asking you, what pushed you specifically in this direction? How did that start?
It actually had started about a decade earlier in conversations with the late Senator Barry Goldwater. After the 94 election, the senator and I, who had known each other for years, I'd known his son, Barry Jr., who was a roommate in prep school. We got to talking about what was happening to conservatism. He was saying that he was both mystified and miffed about what was going on with the incivility in conservatism. He said, I don't understand these attacks on Bill and Hillary Clinton. He specifically mentioned somebody apparently had sent him a copy of the Jerry Falwell tape that had Clinton engaged in murder and drug pushing and just you name it, and it was in there. And he said, you know, I might not agree with everything that Bill Clinton does or all his policies, but I do think we only have one president at a time, and you just can't throw this kind of crap, if you'll excuse me, at a president on such a sustained basis and hope for the man to ever get anything accomplished. And he said, I'm terribly distressed with what conservatives are doing. We talked about the fact that the religious right had taken really control of the Republican Party, and he thought that the party had sold its soul as a result of that just to get to win elections. And he said, John, what I would like to do is find why this is happening. I have some ideas myself. I've got some sources I can talk to. You probably no doubt have ideas. You no doubt have sources. And as we talked about this, we said, well, let's do a book and find the answers. And that was the genesis of this book. It obviously is a play on the title of his classic, The Conscience of a Conservative. The play was, he said, I think conservatism has lost its conscience. And we actually developed this title in our conversations.
So after you wrote the other book, that's when you decided to just tackle this?
What had happened is Senator Goldwater became ill. I had to put the book on the shelf. He then passed away. I didn't drop it. But then things began happening that made me think about the project we had started and how important it was to continue it. There were a series of things. First of all, there was the reason I happened to call him in 1994, which was that I was in the middle of a lawsuit. There had been a book published called Silent Coup, which claimed that my wife was involved with a call girl ring operating out of the Democratic National Committee, and that secretly and unknown to any investigator, any prosecutor, any historian, any journalist, all these years, that I had secretly ordered the Watergate break-in and done so because my wife, who was affiliated with this call girl ring, along with, incidentally, every attractive woman in Washington at the time, and I was looking for sexual dirt on the Democrats, then managed to somehow fool all my colleagues to cover this up for me. And how the publisher thought I wouldn't sue, I to this day don't know. We did sue. We did succeed after they spent $15 million fighting us. And 8 years, they realized they couldn't use a scorched earth policy and make me disappear. And at that point, they agreed to settle. And the reason they settled is the source of this story might have been in the annals of defamation law the worst conceivable source you could have found. He was a man who was in and out of mental institutions his entire adult life. He actually claimed he was from Alpha Centauri. he was a deserted space captain who was waiting for the ship to come pick him up. In reality, he was once a Washington lawyer who represented pimps and prostitutes. He had been involved in the defense of some rather unseemly people, and he was involved in extorting young women into prostitution. He was sent to jail as a result of that, and he then concocted this story when he came back, and the person who seemed to buy it most solidly was the man who would end up promoting Silent Coup most vigorously is G. Gordon Liddy, who would go around the country selling this book to conservatives. That's one of the reasons I called the senator. I said, Senator, I don't understand why conservatives with a modicum of intelligence would buy into this bogus story. And he then put it in a broader context. He said, John, this is what conservatism is doing today, and it is very distressing. Then other events would happen. During the lawsuit, I remained a very low profile, as I had in business. In 98, as the Lewinsky matter became the front page news, I decided to do what I had not done, and that is to speak out when people were claiming things were worse than Watergate, when I knew very well they were not. So when I was called by MSNBC to do a number of programs, I finally agreed to go to Washington to serve as a on-air consultant. During that tenure, I learned an awful lot about what was going on in Washington. It was really the first intense visit I'd had post-Watergate. Found a very different city, found a very different Congress, and I found it because most of these people who were players in the impeachment proceeding had passed through one time or another the green room, and I had lengthy conversations with them, probed them, in fact, kept a fairly detailed journal of that time, which I would never publish because they were totally off-the-record remarks, but it was a hell of an education, and I realized something was astray in the way Washington was working that was very different. There was really, I didn't know the formal title and label you'd put on it, but I did know it was either dictatorial or authoritarian or certainly very different than the House, where you'd had chairmen who had risen through seniority to control and have their own fiefdoms who would or would not check the leadership or go along with the leadership, had all gone away, and Newt Gingrich had imposed a very strict rule in the House. He selected the chairman. He did so not on the basis of their knowledge or ability necessarily, but rather their ability to raise money for Republican coffers using the leverageship of their chairmanship. I saw people go through the green room who told me they were very opposed to what the Republicans were doing. There was a poll, for example, the week before the House impeachment inquiry started that showed that 60% of the Republican Party opposed the impeachment drive. They did not believe the 96 election should be reversed by the House of Representatives and the Senate. I asked people who were coming through the green room why they insisted on going forward when their party was so deeply opposed to it. And I was told repeatedly the same thing, that the leadership wanted it. The leadership wanted it because 30% of those who were polled, the core, the base, if you will, the social conservatives, they were demanding it. And the leadership wanted to please them because these were the bees, these were the workers in the Republican organization, and they had a tremendous influence that far exceeded their numbers. So I watched members of the House who I knew in their conscience did not want to vote for impeachment because of their fear of the leadership, because of their being forced to move in lockstep, voted for Clinton's impeachment. Then, finally, when I promised myself when I turned 60 I'd start writing again, and did, and started writing columns about the Bush administration, because I said, these people don't realize they're just making the same mistakes we made during the Nixon presidency. It's as if they found an old playbook that they, down in the basement, and said, this looks pretty good, let's do it, let's try it.
Well, they did. They found Dick Cheney.
Well, actually, Cheney was not a part. He was in the Nixon administration.
But he was not part of that.
But he was way down in the pecking order, working for Don Rumsfeld. But he somehow suffered a trauma sitting there as Gerald Ford's chief of staff. As the Congress deconstructed the imperial presidency, Dick Cheney went through some experience that he's never recovered from that has made him hell-bent the rest of his life to try to rebuild the presidency to its pre-Watergate Vietnam status, apparently so he can repeat Vietnam and Watergate.
John Dean, that brings us to where we are now. And in reading your book, you start off talking about conservatism, how on that level you haven't changed. You're still a Goldwater conservative in certain terms, I guess.
On many issues, yes.
And the Republican Party has completely changed.
Well, in fact, it has moved so far to the right that I find myself on the left of the spectrum today.
And I'm nothing more than, you know, an old Humphrey liberal, and I'm not even part of the debate anymore. That's what scares me. But I noticed something. You start talking about, at the beginning, about ideology, and gradually there's a shift. And the last two-thirds of the book are non-ideological. What you're talking about, in fact, are personalities, the authoritarian followers and the authoritarian leaders. It's as if all of that other stuff has suddenly or slowly been stripped away, and we're just left with, I don't want to use these kinds of words, but, you know, an American version of a fascist or a Nazi. I mean, we call them authoritarians or Republicans, but it's the American version.
Well, that's the reason I went through the drill of explaining conservatism is because I found so few conservatives really knew anything about the conservative canon. They knew very little about the traditions and evolution of conservatism, modern conservatism. So I tried to compress that to show and also that the roots of conservatism were rather thin, rather shallow, and thus when the authoritarians came in to play, they were able very easily to remake conservatism in their own image, and they have done just that. So that's why it wasn't strong enough. It wasn't like classic liberalism that had evolved over decade after decade after decade. This is something that was relatively new. It was largely concocted. It was done by twisting history here and there, and it didn't stand up well when the authoritarians decided to come in and remake it in the way they wanted it. And that's exactly what they've done. And there are two groups. There are the social conservatives and there are the neoconservatives. Interestingly, the social conservatives have very authoritarian personalities as well. The neoconservatives, some do, some don't. Their policies, however, are highly authoritarian. And those two groups dominate conservatism and Republican politics today. And then I go on in the book to show the implications of this using personalities, naming names, showing how these people, these aren't me labeling these people in such a way. This is based on solid social science that developed right up in the Bay Area here in Berkeley. It started, and it's really a half century of research, of empirical questioning of tens of thousands of people where you see these repeating patterns. So when I've used these labels on these people as being right-wing authoritarian followers or social dominating authoritarian leaders, this isn't just some label that some social scientist has laid on them. It's something that they themselves have in anonymous testing repeatedly explained. I also talked to social scientists about, could I take that criteria, that data, and apply it to personalities who openly admitted this was their behavior? And they said, absolutely. In fact, we hope somebody someday would do that with our research. The frustrating thing about this is all this material is there, and it's never been made public. It's never been made available for the general reader. How this has happened, I don't know. It's too important because you're right. When you say, where does this all go? It is proto-fascist behavior. Now, are we on the road to fascism? I don't think we're on it today, but I talked to a lot of political scientists, others who'd study fascism, and I was told consistently they were very aware of authoritarianism. They said, John, we're not that far away. And if we have another 9/11, which will be worse than the one we had, it could very easily be that people will willingly submit to a fascist face with a smile on it, willingly giving up one right and liberty after another until they've lost their freedom. And that's the reason for this book and laying this argument out. And it's not an effort to be pejorative about these people, but rather descriptive because they are what they are.
It strikes me in looking at where we are now, a 9/11 would throw it over the top. But I'm also looking at three other factors, John Dean. Let me ask you about them. One is the Supreme Court. Now, there was a 5-3 vote on Guantanamo, but that's a lot closer than we thought. That's really Anthony Kennedy.
You mean Hamden?
Yeah, Anthony Kennedy determining that the executive did not have that power. But four Supreme Court justices pretty much said that in wartime the president does. That's one. The second is the nature of voting irregularities.
Let's just pause on that one.
Okay.
You notice the Bush response to that has been to come to Congress and ask them to legitimize what the Supreme Court, at least five members of the Supreme Court, said was improper, did not have any due process about it. While they didn't come down hard on exactly what should be done, it's certainly implicit in their decision that there was no due process in the procedure right.
Set up.
And the Bush people are asking Congress to just approve this and, in a sense, shove this right down the Supreme Court's throat, at least four members, if they can now marshal five, because Roberts had recused himself since he'd ruled on the Court of Appeals.
That was my point. We're one vote away
right.
from that, doing an end run. At this point, I would hope that Congress is sufficiently angered by the usurpation of power, but who knows?
Well, you know, there have been glimmers of institutional pride in Congress under Republican control, but they're glimmers at best. Occasionally, an Arlen Specter will say, hey, we need a hearing on signing statements. These are a slap in the face of
right.
Congress. But nothing happens. He has held a number of hearings on the warrantless wiretapping under NSA, but yet nothing's happened. So how serious he is, I don't know. How much control his caucus has on him, I don't know. If the control of Congress does not change in 06 and authoritarian leaders stay in power, then we have something to be worried about.
And that brings up my next point, which was voting irregularities. Several people, Mark Crispin Miller, who's a media professor at NYU, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., among others, claim that perhaps Kerry won the 2004 election, not just electoral votes, but Miller goes further and says perhaps in the popular vote as well. And 2000, we know what happened. 2005, we saw in Ohio, if you looked, that there were four measures to reform the electoral situation in Ohio prior to the vote. I don't know if you know this. Of those four measures, two of them were close. Two of them were winning substantially by close to a 60-40, 57-43 margin. All four went down to defeat 60-40, which says something is rotten in the state of Ohio.
Well, I've looked at this issue.
Yeah.
In California, of course, we, as it now stands, need a paper record to have electronic voting. I think that ought to be the norm. There's no question that election fraud is not new. It may be technology has improved the skill of those to do it. I don't know the answer to this yet. I've looked at it. I've read about it. I read Kennedy's piece in Rolling Stone, which was excellent. It's a frightening collection of the information. And there is a potential problem. The good part of this, though, is that so many people are looking for this problem and are aware of it. It's going to be very difficult to pull it off. I'm one who thinks that these grand conspiracies are often more speculative than reality because, first, you can't get that many people to keep a secret. Secondly, people aren't that smart and clever.
Well, what Miller says is if it was a conspiracy, it's going to come out pretty quick. It hasn't come out, but then again, as we've also learned, you know, it only takes a couple of people at Diebold to play the game.
Well, if you get enough people in the authoritarian ranks, you don't need to worry about this. They'll march in lockstep anyway.
The other element of the consolidation of power would be media manipulation, which starts with the right-wing media, but then moves into how the mainstream media can be manipulated into the he-said-she-said journalistic dynamics or gotcha journalism, which brings us back to how did we get here? And the answer is somebody wasn't keeping their eye out.
You know, I've looked at this because the books I write, for example, The Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, I wrote that because the mainstream media was ignoring the secrecy issue. Now, I think it's pretty widely accepted that we have a highly secretive presidency. The mainstream media talks about it fairly openly now. It's no secret about the secrecy any longer. In raising the issue of authoritarianism, I mean, this is material that's been sitting around for a long time. An enterprising journalist could easily have gotten there. But let me tell you the response I get when I talk to journalists on both sides, right and left, in Washington who cover national politics. They say, John, we don't have the time anymore to do the sort of thing that you do. Our editors don't give us the kind of latitude. It's very likely you couldn't have a Woodward and Bernstein assigned to one story to chase it to the end of the earth, as happened back in 1972, 73, 74, because corporate media is so bottom-line driven, they're cutting those staffs so tight, these guys have so much on their platter, they just don't have time to develop this kind of material. What happens is when they want to get into something, they take a leave of absence and try to get an advance for a book and go out and get into a subject. But otherwise, on their daily journalism, it's not. The other problem is that young people have turned away from newspapers, not while they like the blogs and like to get the cross-references. They're really not buying papers. And at some point, the availability of resources to even gather news is going to be in jeopardy.
There's also what I call the Republican funding hydra, which is a series of foundations and the Cato Institute, American Enterprise Institute, Heritage Foundation. These people throw out so much information and disinformation at the same time, that there's such a glut that we can't, unless you're really up on it, you can't find your way through it. It's like you've entered this jungle of stuff just thrown at you.
Well, I deal with that in the book, and the influence of people like the Heritage Institute and the other AEI and all of them. And I did actually put a table in where I tried to see what kind of impact they were having on Capitol Hill. And it's significant, but not terribly important yet. It is more a sales tool for the right, as it could be for the left as well, although the Brookings Institute, which was once considered left, is now considered very moderate to even conservative on many issues. So there's no question that they are putting out a lot of material, but it's somewhat preaching to the choir, if you will, and giving the choir arguments to make and data, and it's used on Capitol Hill to bolster arguments. Sometimes the other side gets in and dissects it and shows the weaknesses of the arguments. Other times they ignore it. So what I do myself is when I look at research, I look at the researcher's work. And if he doesn't back up his work, I don't rely on his information. If I can't go to his sources to find his data, it's not worth anything to me.
And then you have to analyze the data yourself.
Absolutely.
You're listening to an interview with John Dean, whose latest book is Conservatives Without Conscience. We also have the contrarian science. The idea that there are two sciences, Republican and Democratic science, and that's not true either, but the authoritarians are using it, again, to create this static so people won't detect what's really going on.
Well, it's the whole thing like the religious right in their drive to have intelligence design taught in schools. It's one of the hot items on their agenda. It's the global warming issue. Just throw up enough, you know, it's become that you can find scientists like lawyers, you can get an opinion on anything if you just find the right person to write it, which is unfortunate because science is something that tends to be true in that it can be replicated by others, and it's often jargon-filled and chart-filled and very difficult for the average person to get in there, and other scientists don't always have the chance to deconstruct it. But there's no question that the Republicans and the authoritarians who are trying to pull the wool have gotten very good at it by using these techniques. There's a very interesting monograph I read some years ago about the effort of the anti-intellectual propensity of presidents, how it has grown. Nixon was certainly a very intellectual president and surrounded himself. And if you start going down the line after Reagan, there is a trend in Republican presidents to be anti-intellectual. The criteria for voting is, would you enjoy having a beer with this guy? Would you like to spend a weekend with him? You know, not whether how well he might run the country, which is not unlike they're pushing the argument that only they know how to run a war, when they really have not run any successful ones.
that's just the confluence of authoritarianism, incompetence, and hubris all going on at once.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I found that the authoritarians tend to self-destruct sooner or later. They just keep pushing until they finally they've gone over the cliff or they crash.
I was going to ask you this later. Let's talk for a second about 2008. You know, what scares me is I don't see these people wanting to give up power. So does that mean that McCain joins them? Does that mean that Frist gets elected? Where are we going then?
Well, I'm one who happens to be convinced that when that great middle, the public, we're a bell curve, if you will. We're on the fringe. You have the right and the left. They're setting the agenda because they're drawing the attention with the conflict they create that attracts media attention. But most people fall in the middle, and we've always been a centrist nation. And once information starts bubbling up, the problem with campaigns to me are they are dumbing down into being just nothing but media events and sound bites, and the candidates are so packaged that you don't know really who you've got there until they're in and govern for a while. George Bush ran for all practical purposes as a moderate. No one thought he was a hard right person. He gets in, turns hard right, and never turns back. There was never any doubt in my mind about Cheney. I didn't realize it was as complete as it is, but Cheney, the vice presidency, has clearly swallowed the presidency in this instance. He's got enormous power. I don't think that will happen again soon without people being very alert to it. As people get educated, and we have more means to do that now, the Internet has been a great educator, a great leveler. As newspapers have become weaker, the Internet has grown stronger. As television has gotten more expensive and less educational or explicit, we're finding other places and books. You know, it's very interesting. My agent happened to notice the other day, he said, you know, all of the material that really has become explanatory about Bush has come out in books, not in newspaper articles or not in in-depth essays in magazines. It's been books this time. So there are ways to get this information out to the public, and it's just whether the public is inclined to pick it up and learn about it.
That's why I was kind of disheartened the other day when I noticed that a year ago, 35% of Americans believed that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. That number's up to 50%. And that's because of a new push by Karl Rove. And I'm going, you know, what planet are we on?
But that is a very authoritarian type follower trait. When the authority speaks, they salute and they listen and they don't argue with it. They don't engage in critical thinking, and it explains so much of their behavior, why they don't. There was a very interesting poll that was taken the week before the 2004 vote with Kerry voters and Bush voters on these very issues and who knew what. The Kerry voters were very well educated. They were, you know, something like 35% believed that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. Whereas you go over to the Bush voters, and something like 70% of them are convinced that Saddam Hussein is involved in 9/11, which is preposterous. But that's the message they're putting out, and it's the message the foot soldiers are buying.
Let's turn it around for a second, John Dean. Let's talk about the Democrats.
I'll tell you something that's interesting in the authoritarian testing. The Democrats and the left do not test high on the authoritarian scales at all. And to the contrary, they're very low. This may well explain why, indeed, it's hard to get them to march in lockstep, because they're like herding cats.
Right.
They are people who actually notice that there is nuance in the world, that not everything is black and white, that there are grays. They are different personalities. They actually think, and they don't uncritically accept as gospel. Now, this isn't very good for winning elections. It happens to be very healthy for democracy, however. I don't know what the short-term solution, but it looks to me like Democrats are getting, as they came close in 2004, just so disgusted with what's happening on the other side that they will keep themselves get together long enough. The other thing is, understand that Republicans and the right is really made up of many factions who do not agree, and they're quite inconsistent and quite at opposite ends on many issues, but yet they have found a few binding issues that glue them together. Once it was communism, or anti-communism, I should say, and then it was liberalism, but liberalism is something of a straw man to beat to death, and while Ann Coulter still does so, it doesn't really, it's not much of a reality to it. Judicial activism is one of the new ones, and they're now trying to go and use terrorism to say, well, only Republicans can fight terrorism, and use that as the glue that holds them together. But that's just enough to keep them, these factions, which are, they could really break up at any time, and that would hurt the Republican Party very badly.
I ran into you in the hallway at KPFA several years ago. We started talking about William Safire, who I'd interviewed not that long before, and you said to me, do you think he believes what he's saying? And I said, it doesn't seem that way. And you said, no, it didn't seem that way to me. And, of course, you knew him during the Nixon years. That brings up a question that I've been trying to ask different people, which is these pundits, when they go off like that, you've, I guess, talked to them in green rooms, did they believe what they're saying?
Well, it depends upon the person. When I, for example, you know, with Bill Safire, he is clearly to me at heart a libertarian, and he has to swallow a lot of things and accept a lot of things to create the acceptance he did as a columnist in a wide range within the conservative ranks. So I'm not always sure that he bought everything that he sometimes pushed. But I, you know, I don't know. I've never really talked to him. I think he's an honest man, and if you ever ask him, he would give you an honest answer. It's also playing to your reader at times.
Well, sure, but what about some of these other people, the O'Reillys, the Coulters? Do they believe this stuff? Should we care that they believe it?
Well, I don't know. I think somebody should cut Ann Coulter's testosterone off. You know, she clearly, as I treat them in the book, and it's not seriously because I don't think they add anything that's serious. They are playing to the choir. Ann Coulter is clearly a bomb thrower, and she just does it for the attention it creates to her works. And she's laughing all the way to the bank. I don't think it adds anything to the debate. I don't know anybody who really takes her terribly seriously, so I don't find her much of a threat. I don't think I've ever listened to Rush Limbaugh. I've heard excerpts streamed, and I've read transcripts of his material. But I, you know, while he may reinforce those who are already committed and who are already authoritarian conservatives, I don't think that he's changing any minds, and I think that people view him for what he is, and he's a political entertainer.
George Lakoff here in Berkeley, you mentioned briefly in your book in terms of, you know, the Democrats is the mommy party and the Republicans is the daddy party, and obviously it's a lot deeper than that, and that's
it's a nice metaphor.
It's a nice metaphor, but Lakoff's view in his more recent book seems to be that these folks, the authoritarians, they have a different definition of freedom. And while I agree with that, I also wonder, because it means that they're people of good faith. And I wonder, are these people of good faith?
I don't question the motives of any of these people. I don't think that they're evil. I don't think that they are disingenuous. I think they actually believe what they're doing. I look at a Cheney who I am flabbergasted, would go to the Senate and the House and argue for torture. And something in his bonnet has got him convinced that torture works. Where he gets this, and he's unwilling to share any information that shows it, because all of the history and knowledge we have of this cruel and horrible way to treat another human being doesn't show it produces good intelligence. But yet he goes up and pushes torture. We saw 9 members of the Senate vote against the McCain amendment that would have banned torture. You know, what goes through their mind? These are, to me, are conservatives with no conscience. Now, how they get there is probably a different route by different people. But I do think they actually believe or... Here's another situation I must bring to your attention, and that is how easy it is for people in some situations, because I certainly saw it in the Nixon White House, to set aside their conscience and to adopt the conscience of their authority, like Nixon. And if he thinks it's right, by golly, it's right by them.
How hard was it for you in those days to say, no, Mr. President, you're wrong?
It was not easy, and I went into it gently. In listening to the tapes of my conversations with him, when I was trying to, first of all, find out how much he really knew, because I now know he knew a lot more than he was telling me, and I suspected that at the time, but you don't go into the leader of the Western world who you work at his pleasure and say you're full of SHI, whatever.
Right, yeah.
and you treat it gently. So, and that's exactly what I did. You know, I realized that... He was getting my message, too, that I realized that this was a problem and that, what you know, I was being very blunt with him, telling him there's a cancer on the presidency, that we're obstructing justice. I'm not mincing words with him, and he got them. But he also just upped the cover-up as a result. But it was very hard, and it was very hard to testify against these people. And any of those for whom I had any respect, I told them exactly what I was going to do before I did it. And I said, listen, you know, I've been trying to tell you guys for a long time that we're obstructing justice, we're in trouble, it's not going to go away, and we're going to have to pay the piper. We got the president elected, and if we can get him out in front of this and he does the right thing, he may survive. If not, we're all going to go down the tube. But I'm not going to be the guy that falls on the sword for anybody. And I'm not going to lie for anybody. And I got that message across to everybody, as I say, I had any respect for, which were basically all my superiors, just out of courtesy in many regards. It's not pleasant to be the whistleblower. And I wanted them to know how I was going to do it.
But there are no John Deans, it seems, in this administration at all. I mean, and no Nixons who would even listen to that degree.
Well, you know, that's one of the interesting things I learned about these authoritarian personalities. You cannot change them. I saw it in Nixon. Once they lock in, they just do not change. And Altmaier, the professor from Manitoba, University of Manitoba, who guided me into so much of this material, really comes down to a number of about 23 to 25% of the American public who are authoritarians, and we're not going to do anything to change them. We're not going to change their style. We're not going to make them less nasty. We're not going to make them elevate the debate. This is the way they're going to play the game. And so it's better to understand them and be able to deal with them accordingly and prevent others from following in their footsteps. And that's part of the goal of my book, is so that if we do have another 9/11, somebody say, hey, wait a minute, I read something about how people can get in very deep without even realizing it.
Well, one of the reasons I asked you about the about whether they're men of good faith, men and women of good faith, is because we're also seeing things like war profiteering in Iraq. You know, by Halliburton, you know, Dick Cheney is still getting money from him. We're seeing this kind of corruption, K Street, at the same time.
The authoritarian personality is so self-righteous in its own belief of its actions and its activities that they can't see it that way. They just don't see any wrong. They can, a Karl Rove can with a straight face, tell you that adult embryo can be developed better than stem cell embryo and has more promise, notwithstanding the fact that you could find no science to support this, nor any study that they relied on, and probably believe that he's doing something that is good by dealing with this because he's looking at it from a different perspective. He's looking at, is he somehow furthering his religious beliefs and those of the president, which he thinks trump science in this instance.
John Dean, it would seem, okay, if you have these authoritarian followers, as you describe in your book, Conservatives Without Conscience, and you've got these leaders called double high authoritarians who are defined by certain characteristics, who are leading the pack. And then you've got on the other side liberals and moderates. Is it up to conservatives then? Because maybe the authoritarians would listen to them, conservatives like you and others, to stand up and say no?
Well, that's certainly one of my goals. Now, not that the 23 to 25% is going to listen to what I have to say, but others may say, and me, indeed, I've got to tell you, I was up in Seattle, saw one of my former colleagues, Bud Krogh, up there, who had just finished the book. He's a good Republican. He's a good conservative. And he said, John, thank you for writing this book. I signed it to him, to my non-authoritarian friend, Bud Krogh, because he's not. There are other conservatives I've talked to. I've done a fair amount of right-wing radio.
Right.
Day before yesterday, I did Michael Medved's show. He has a highly conservative audience. When the calls came in, he was really expecting there'd be a lot of attacks on me. But what comes up on the board are people who are agreeing with me, and it kind of surprised him. They're solid conservatives. They called and said, yeah, I never noticed it, but John's right. There is a nasty, mean streak out there, and these people are authoritative. And it was delightful to hear somebody coming from just out of the cold who hadn't even thought about this, and maybe it'll change their mind.
Well, I never noticed there was a nasty streak. I mean, that's been going on for a decade.
Well, that's because they're in the ranks, and they don't see themselves that way because they're so self-righteous. And maybe by somebody else pointing out what's happening, I can help. You know, that's one of the goals of the book, of course, is to stop this activity because it is not healthy in a democracy.
Well, and that's why I say it almost seems as if the left has been fighting this and the moderates have been fighting it for a long time. But if it's ever going to change, it's got to be people within who say enough is enough.
Well, that's right. You know, if you said it and brought out a study on authoritarianism, or somebody else on the left did, it would be absolutely bashed. And they were trying to do that to me initially, but when they found out that it's not me that's saying this, but I'm relying on very hard science, it makes it very hard to make it bat away. Now, they'll attack the messenger, but then the message will get on through because it doesn't bother me when they attack the messenger.
Well, what kind of attacks have you gotten for this book?
Well, as I explained in the very going into the book, the fact I've spoken out in the past. You know, I was attacked for telling the truth about Watergate.
Yeah, but we're talking about now.
Oh, it hasn't, you know, it hasn't developed yet, but it will. I mean, it's inevitable. I mean, it just comes with the territory.
Do you have a thicker skin about it now?
It doesn't bother me.
Really?
I mean, it does not bother me, or I'm not a masochist. But I put it in perspective. You know, I it is more important to me to get the truth out there and let the chips fall. And that's always been the way. I'm not a partisan anymore. I don't push for either party. I'm registered as an independent. If I'm a partisan for one thing, I've seen government work and I've seen it not work. And I think it can work. I'm a guy who believes it's half full. I'm a guy who believes that the American public, when they have knowledge, will do the right thing. So by golly, I'm going to do my best to get it out there.
How do you think the Middle East crisis at the moment plays into this, or does it play into it?
Well, I think it does play into it because we saw Cheney acting on it the other night down in Tampa, where he told the audience that you've got to keep electing Republicans because only we can handle what's happening in the Middle East. Now, this is baloney, but of course, it's more fear-mongering, and they have mastered the fear-mongering, and the data shows that when people become frightened, they move into the authoritarian following ranks.
I read Ron Susskind's 1% Doctrine, and you did not. You have not read it yet.
No.
The rationale behind that is that if there's one chance in 100 that an event will occur, we have to act as if it does. Everything seems to follow out of that.
Well, you know, that's the same argument that I've heard, I've gotten into with a couple talk radio hosts about torture. They say, what about the ticking bomb, John? Wouldn't you accept that it is we moral if you could go in and torture a man who is about to drop a bomb in or release a bomb in New York City that will level Manhattan, and you, by torturing him, you can get the location of that bomb and defuse it and stop it. I said, of course, anybody would say it's morally proper to do that, to save all those lives. But the problem is it's a fallacious rhetorical argument, and it's not a reality, and you can't base a policy on that kind of thinking.
Well, on top of that, the CIA has understood, and that's also in the Susskind book, that in fact that kind of torture doesn't work. If you want to get information,
right,
you put out the carrot, you don't put out the stick.
Well, the FBI has established this over years of very careful training, practice, and development, and that's one of the reasons that they were so horrified with what they saw down in Guantanamo, because, one, they knew it wouldn't work, and it wasn't producing the results, and they were anxious to get the intelligence before these people were absolutely destroyed through torture, because they obviously you can't go into court later with evidence that's obtained by torture, which obviously has jeopardized every case in Guantanamo. I don't know if you've read that book, Guantanamo. It's an excellent work. It shows that, you know, there's probably not a case that you could legitimately try in the American jurisprudence system right now. So they're going to have to create some kind of system that they can tag these people somehow, and hopefully the Congress will act with some wisdom and not let innocent people and 14-year-old boys be accused of being Al-Qaeda operatives.
Well, as with everything else, what will wind up happening is that the bad guys will be released with the good because the discrimination has gone away.
That's a good point.
John W. Dean, let me ask you this, because we're in Berkeley and I have a leftist liberal audience. What could we do to fight authoritarian? Do we just sit back and say, well, you know, we're not part of that world, and no matter how many times we demonstrate, they're just going to laugh at us? What do we do?
That is maybe the most important question you've asked me. It probably is your last question you've asked me, and let me tell you why it's so important to me. Everywhere I've gone on this tour, that question has either come up first or somewhere along the line and repeatedly, and particularly by people who are in the boomer plus generation, who they've raised their family. They were once very politically active. They've now they've got their family grown, and they want to go back and say, what can we leave as our legacy, because we were once very active and wanted to be involved and change the world, and we haven't completed the job. It is so important that I'm not going to give you a glib answer, but I will tell you what I told my wife the other night, is that this question has come up so much it looks like it's got to be my next book, because I have access to people. I have a lot of ideas. I've got access to people who can give me further ideas. People like Altmaier are doing studies right now on how to deal with authoritarians, because they're a very unique breed, and he's actually running tests right now. That material may well form the next book. I'm seriously considering it, but I will give you this answer that all politics is local.
John W. Dean, that will probably be your next book. You've already started working on it, I would hope.
I'm certainly thinking about it, yes.
I mean, well, that's one question. The other is, I didn't ask you about how the environment plays into this, because that's another issue.
Well, I gather you'll clip this together. As far as the environment goes, I didn't really focus on any specific policies and other than in passing. And I can only tell you this on the environmental issue. A member in good standing of the Green Party came up to me the other night, who's been active his entire life in the Green Party, and said, "John, we'd run Richard Nixon right now for president and be happy." That's how bad it's gotten.
You've been listening to an interview with John W. Dean, whose latest book is Conservatives Without Conscience. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.